One of the things that we're learning about Hawaii is that people came to Hawaii an awful lot later than we thought they did. We thought that the Polynesians came to Hawaii, say, in the area of 300, 400, 500 AD. But now we're learning that they really came more in the area of 1100, 1200, 1250 AD. I mean, that's 700, 800 years later. So there's really a much shorter history of Hawaii than we think. The Polynesians that first came to Hawaii actually brought very established political institutions and cultures with them. And they then adapted those institutions to their situation in Hawaii. Hawaiians essentially reconfigured the islands into a network of extremely productive farms that left Hawaii a relatively well-off society. They're able to have very extensive networks of taro farms. And the taro farms tend to produce a lot of food per worker put into the taro field. A single worker could support from 5 to 10 people. So that meant that you could support a population of artists, religious specialists, politicians, fishermen. I mean, you could support all sorts of people that become the mix for relatively advanced culture. With the centralization of government under Kamehameha, the 19th century essentially saw this vast fall in Hawaiian population. If we're looking at the population between 1778, we're still debating how many people were here during that period, but I think somewhere between 400,000 and 500,000 people were here in the islands. And all of a sudden, the native Hawaiian population is down to less than 50,000 at the turn of the 20th century. That's a massive decline in populations, and it's mostly due to diseases that are introduced from the West. And that creates crises in Hawaiian society. And the crises come because chiefs, who previously had a very ample labor force. That's a pretty good population for Hawaii, 400 to 500,000 on the eve of contact. Today, we only have 1.4 million, so it says there's a lot of people here at contact with the West. I mean, that population basically disappears. And for the chiefs, that means there's no one to work their lands. In the early 19th century, they start looking for other opportunities. I mean, one opportunity was sandalwood. One opportunity is whaling. But those are really opportunities that outsiders are controlling. Sandalwood is very limited because you're harvesting a limited stock of sandalwood. The whaling trade, you're basically limited to servicing the whaling ships. A lot of Hawaiians become sailors on those ships. And so they're looking for something where their lands can be worked. And sugar is one of the things all of a sudden they start to realize, that if they can start sugar plantations, that now that their lands can come back into production.
You outline in the book a situation where you have a rapidly falling population, but at the same time, an increase in the demand for labor to cultivate sugar, work in these new industries. And how does that influence the future political or economic development of Hawaii?
Well, I think it influences the future political development because the chiefs, even early on, saw that if they brought in lots of foreign capital, that there was always a possibility that they would lose control of the situation. And if we look at the institutional arrangements and the organizational arrangements that were put in place in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, most of the sugar enterprises were actually partnerships with the chiefs or with the king. And that they maintained I wouldn't necessarily say a controlling interest, but they maintained an active partnership interest in which they had some control over these enterprises. What happens is that the U.S. Civil War comes along. That leads to a boom in sugar production, a really short-lived boom, just from 1860 to 1865. And then after 1865, when sugar production in the U.S. South comes online, all of a sudden the demand for Hawaii sugar goes down. There's limited markets for Hawaii sugar around the world. And so there's a drumbeat in Hawaii among the sugar planters that, gee, we need a reciprocity treaty with the United States. A treaty with the United States in which we can get sugar into the United States duty-free, and then U.S. goods would come to Hawaii duty-free. And that treaty is actually enacted in 1876. And as a result of the treaty, the sugar enterprises expand dramatically. I mean, just over a period of less than a decade, there's a tenfold increase. Instead of having, say, 10 plantations, all of a sudden you're up there with 60 large plantations.
And so just the reduction in duties and tariffs from this treaty made Hawaiian sugar competitive on an international market.
It did. And, you know, in some ways, it's kind of a false competitiveness. Suppose, for example, that that the U.S. and other countries had no duties or tariffs on sugar. Hawaii was really not that well suited for sugar production. Yes, there would have been some sugar production in Hawaii, but it wouldn't have been the massive producer of sugar that it became in some sense. We would have found that that the U.S. mostly imported sugar from the Caribbean, where there was much lower cost production in the Caribbean. And Hawaii is the only place that's able to come in under the U.S. tariff umbrella. And the U.S. tariff umbrella is high, so they impose 40% tariffs. So what that essentially means is that the price which is garnered by a sugar producer in Hawaii is approximately 40% higher than the price that a sugar producer in Jamaica or Cuba. That's a massive premium. What happens is that also means Hawaii becomes very dependent on the U.S. market. And as it becomes dependent on the U.S. market, that actually leaves a lot of power with the U.S. government. And when the treaty is up for renewal in the mid-1880s, the U.S. government looks at the treaty and says, we should be able to squeeze more out of the Hawaiians. They're very dependent on us. And so the government asks that the U.S. warships be allowed to establish coaling stations in Pearl Harbor. And then in Hawaii, there's tremendous controversy about that. A lot of people believe this is going to be a loss of sovereignty. It's eventually going to lead to annexation by the United States. It leads to some political turmoil. And when it looks like the Hawaiian government and the king, Kalakaua at the time, are not going to agree to the change, then a small group of white residents of the islands comes and confronts the king. An armed group comes and confronts the king and demands that he sign a treaty that involves this cession of rights to the United States. And Kalakaua does. And that's really the definitive moment. The annexation, I think, just kind of comes naturally after that. It comes naturally after that because the Caucasian community in Hawaii has organized in some ways and realized that they can put pressure on the government. And the Hawaiian community has problems really responding to this well.
That type of hardball diplomacy on behalf of private enterprise is something that is not so unfamiliar today.
No, and you know, there's a great book by an economist, Noel Maurer, who's at George Washington University. It's called The Empire Trap, and it really talks about this is a strategy that the U.S. used throughout the early 19th century. And it's a strategy that we should be familiar with today. I mean, President Trump has looked at numerous treaties with small countries. And, you know, one of the things about treaties, about free trade treaties between small countries and large countries is most of the gains typically go to the small country. The reason why is having access to the markets of a large country is a really valuable thing. And for the United States to have access to the markets of a small country, well, it's less valuable. You're just not going to generate as many gains. Trump has looked at many of these treaties, say Korea, and said, oh, we're not getting enough gains. Okay, basically go out and say to the Koreans, hey, you become dependent on exporting to the U.S. market. We want more. So pay for a lot more of the U.S. troops in Korea. It's the same type of bullying strategy that the U.S. used back in the 19th century. In some sense, things never change, although I do want to note that that's certainly not the policy of the United States over the period of the 1960s through the first decade of the 21st century. We were much more internationalist then. We were looking really at putting these treaties together so that the U.S. would have sufficient markets on the outside. The idea wasn't so much that we had to get the lion's share of the gains. The idea was that we got gains out of dealing with these countries and that these countries had a place to deal with, they had a place to trade with outside of, say, Russia or China. The old system was a pretty good system. The same thing is happening today when we put pressure on these small countries is I think it tends to create political turmoil within the countries.
Well, we know that since the overthrow, the plantation system in Hawaii declined and has almost entirely gone away. What happens after the annexation to get us to where we are now?
Well, you know, after the annexation comes colonization by the United States. I mean, annexation essentially means that the U.S. takes over Hawaii. This was never done with the vote of the Hawaiian people. I mean, it's essentially a forced takeover. You have the so-called Republic of Hawaii. This is the government that took over in 1893 that is constantly pushing to cede the islands to the United States. But the majority of the population is totally opposed. You know, measures to annex Hawaii fail in the United States Senate all through the 1890s. And it's only when the Spanish-American War is declared and there's fighting in the Philippines that all of a sudden Congress and the president work to try to find a way to annex Hawaii. And so the same kind of dubious procedure for annexation that was used with Texas is used with Hawaii in 1898. I think the most important thing, though, to note is there was never any consent by Native Hawaiians for annexation. Noe Silva, a political science professor at the University of Hawaii, you know, discovered massive numbers of petitions that were signed by almost all of the Native Hawaiian residents of the island opposing annexation. And they were brought to the U.S. Congress, and Congress and the president were well aware of the massive opposition to essentially the U.S. taking an independent country in the Pacific. Once Hawaii, once the U.S. takes over, I mean, essentially there's a colonial government in Hawaii. The United States president appoints the governor. The United States president essentially appoints the Supreme Court justices. Yeah, there's an elected legislature, but the electorate is quite diminished. Essentially, what we have in this colonial government is we end up with political coalitions that just encompass the big interests that are there in Hawaii. That's mostly the big five corporations that are controlling the sugar industry. The U.S. military becomes a big interest as they start to expand bases in Hawaii during that period. And you also see Hawaiians being brought into the coalition somewhat unwillingly because they still want to maintain as some piece of the pie. And Hawaiians are essentially given patronage rights within the government in exchange for votes for the dominant party in the legislature. The next 61 years, the period 1898 all the way through 1959 when statehood comes, I think in many ways is kind of a dark period for Hawaii because it really is a time when Hawaii was ruled as a colony from Washington, D.C., for all intents and purposes. And on the flip side, there's a silver lining to that period. And the silver lining to the period was that in some ways parts of the U.S. Constitution applied. And because parts of the U.S. Constitution applied, it was very difficult to limit groups forming that pushed for a better government to be established in Hawaii. The colonial period, too, I think, is also marked by the disaster of World War II for Hawaii. And the disaster of World War II doesn't just come with the bombing of Pearl Harbor. It also comes with the martial law that was imposed after the bombing. The martial law that's imposed in the islands is far different than the U.S. imposed anywhere else. The civilian government is totally dismantled. The civilian courts are totally dismantled. If you have a traffic ticket, it's held before a military court. Every single action is essentially judged by the military. And I think by the end of the war, people kind of realized that they really were not living in a place where they had any type of self-government. And then after the war, there's a series of very difficult strikes in Hawaii, strikes by workers who felt that they deserved higher wages, the dock workers, an ILWU-led strike, the pineapple workers and the sugar workers. All of them got higher wages. It also imposed a lot of costs on Hawaii, just in the sense that Hawaii kind of got a reputation for not a place that you could do business. And this is a period before the tourists had really started to arrive, before the jet planes.
So how did we get from then to where we are now?
Well, you know, the period after World War II was in some ways a really difficult period for Hawaii. The sugar industry was mechanizing. You know, it was shedding about 5% of its workers each year. A lot of those workers were located over on the Neighbor Islands. And they were not finding new employment on the Neighbor Islands, and they were moving to Oahu. So Oahu was getting a big population increase. And if we look at the late 1940s, early 1950s, we really didn't have the big boom in tourism yet, and that's partly because the jet plane that brought so many tourists to Hawaii hadn't been introduced. That didn't come until the very late 1950s. And when the jet plane came, of course, that provided employment for a lot of the people who moved from the Neighbor Islands to Oahu. The tourism industry developed first in Oahu. You had the Korean War in the early 1950s that gave another impetus of more soldiers coming to Hawaii, more deployment from Hawaii. The Korean War was a time of increasing military expenditures, and Hawaii again became a center of war planning in the Pacific. But once the Korean War ended, some of that stimulus went away. And I think what Hawaii saw at that point in time was that being a territory had a lot of disadvantages. And there was a movement really from the late 1940s for statehood. Statehood was complicated by a number of factors. There were people in the U.S. Senate who were concerned about Hawaii sending two Republican senators to the Senate and changing the balance of power in the Senate. That's kind of funny today because we're a very Democratic state. We sent Democratic senators. But back then it was a very Republican state. This would essentially make Republicans more dominant in the U.S. Senate. There's also concerns about communism in Hawaii. The House Un-American Activities Committee had come to Hawaii, held a series of hearings. Union leaders were indicted, and that also kind of cast a pall over exactly what was going on in Hawaii. Much of that faded in the early 1950s. And you got to remember, too, there's some positives that came out of World War II. One positive was the heroism of many of the soldiers from Hawaii during World War II, in particular the soldiers in the 442nd. that heroism was really understood in the United States. And Hawaii's representatives to the U.S. Congress, elected representatives, but without a vote, and other people lobbying for statehood, essentially used that heroism as a selling point for Hawaii. And I think it was a good selling point. The transition from a colonial order to statehood is a really rough transition in some ways. In Hawaii, it came suddenly. I mean, one day we have a governor who's appointed by the president. The people aren't electing the governor. We have courts that are essentially appointed from the outside. And all of a sudden, there's a new sovereign state where the governor's elected. The courts are appointed by the governor and confirmed by our own Senate. That's really a massive transition. And the massive transition, too, from a colonial order to more of an open society is one where big interests become a little bit less powerful. And in the old colonial order, the big interests dominated, whether it was the interest of the military, the big five corporations, or whether it was the newly ascendant unions who forced their way into the coalition at the end. It was the big elements that dominated. In a more open society, politicians really have to take a look at what's the interest of the median voter. Otherwise, they'll be voted out of office. And that's essentially what happened, I think, in Hawaii in the 1960s and 1970s. When the people of Hawaii looked around and saw their new government, they basically said, hey, we'd like more money spent on education. And more money was pumped into the K-12 system, the primary and secondary educational systems. The University of Hawaii was built up. People saw that as a future for their kids. Future for their kids, whether they were living in Hawaii or not, that they would be educated and they'd be earning higher salaries. There was massive resources put into the University of Hawaii in the 1960s and early 1970s. We also had things like the Prepaid Health Care Act, which was a very egalitarian measure. And so you essentially have the politics of the island moving more toward an egalitarian mix. But I just want to end this note by saying that doesn't mean that large interests still didn't have a lot of power. I mean, large interests in any society have a lot of power. They're large. They're wealthy, and of course they're going to have power on the politics. But they had less power than they did during the colonial era. During the colonial era, your average person had almost no power.
At what point do we really see the transition from several big agricultural producers being the dominant economic force to now where we have the tourism industry is by far the most dominant economic force, and even now we're starting to see real estate?
Well, I think you see this from the 1930s all the way through the 1990s, mostly because of the mechanization in sugar. The mechanization in the sugar and pineapple industries basically meant that the industries were shedding worker and there was more jobs being done by machines. And so in some sense, Hawaii was extremely lucky that the tourism industry started up just as statehood hit. I mean, moving to a new type of political structure is a jarring event, and there can be lots of problems with it. And then all of a sudden, the Hawaii economy is lubricated by literally hundreds of thousands of new tourists, ultimately millions of new tourists coming to Hawaii over the next decade or two. And this enabled Hawaii to invest in infrastructure to support the tourism, but it was also infrastructure that supported people living here in the islands. And you really start to see the decline of the sugar economy come the 1980s and 1990s. I mean, over that period, really a lot of the sugar plantations start to close. And of course, as we talked about before, I think in some ways the sugar industry was kind of an artificial industry in Hawaii. It was essentially, to a very large extent, it was the product of U.S. protectionism, basically taking measures to artificially heighten the price of sugar. Back in the 19th century and through the first half of the 20th century, we relied on very high tariffs that made foreign sugar uncompetitive. And then in the after World War II, we moved more to a quota system. But a quota will have the same effect as a tariff of essentially raising the price of sugar. Without that quota and tariff system, I don't think Hawaii ever would have had the huge sugar economy that it ended up with. And then, of course, during the statehood era, as tourism expanded, there were alternative uses of land in tourism, and there were also alternative uses of land in housing. The price realized by sugar slowly declined over time. Costs in Hawaii seem relatively high compared to places like Thailand or Guatemala. And so for a whole number of reasons, the sugar and pineapple industry declined. There is no sugar industry in Hawaii today, and only the very small remnants of a pineapple industry.
So let's look forward a little bit now. You've examined 800 years of history. Yeah. Is our current economic system sustainable going forward? We just talked about the slow decline of the plantation sugar economy. Is our tourism-centric constant growth model sustainable?
You know, I think it's easy to look at the current system and say that we have lots of problems. I mean, I look at the rise of Airbnb and its competitors of pushing tourists out to the neighborhoods, and the neighborhoods essentially becoming hotel districts. This is a real transition phase. I would very much doubt that the equilibrium that's starting to emerge today of just all of our neighborhoods turning into essentially centers of tourism is the one that we're going to have in the future. I mean, I would be surprised if we didn't see more regulation on that account. It's possible that that's one of the factors pushing up the price of housing in Hawaii. I think tourism is going to remain a linchpin of the economy, but it's interesting how disastrous in many ways our tourism strategy has been. If you go back to the 1990s, and the 1990s were a bad decade for Hawaii. We had the 1980s where there was a boom created by Japanese tourism and by Japanese foreign investment. And then when the Japan economy declined in the 1990s, our economy declined. We were closely tied to Japan. There was a lot of hand-wringing in Hawaii at the time, saying, you know, gee, where's our future tourism going to come from? And there was a strategy adopted that we would try to aim for higher value tourists, tourists who came in and spent a lot of money, and that we had fewer tourists. Because there were fewer tourists, they had less impact on our highways, weren't driving as many rental cars. They had less impact on our environment. Sure, there'd be some eco-tourists, but there weren't going to be that many of them. But essentially what we've seen is we've ended up with the opposite. So nowadays we still have some high-end tourists. All you have to do is walk down Kalakaua Avenue and see the billions of dollars that have been put into the hotels on Kalakaua. We have a lot of high-end tourists. But we also have lots and lots and lots of tourists who come here and really don't spend much money. They're staying out relatively cheap accommodations. They're not spending much money, and they're putting a lot of stress on the infrastructure. And this is the type of model that Hawaii has to get a handle on. I know it's really difficult to try to regulate these types of tourism flows, but we're just left in a new world. If we don't do something to protect our environment against the influx of tourists, we're going to have real severe problems. We had those problems too, of course, back in the 1980s. I remember when I first arrived in Hawaii in the early 1980s. And I went to Hanaba Bay. I was sitting on a beach that was packed with cigarette butts. Now, of course, over time, over the course of the next 20, 25 years, we realized that Hanaba Bay was a really, really valuable asset. We took a lot of measures to try to protect Hanaba Bay. It's been cleaned up. We now see that tourists have to watch educational videos. The place is a lot better off once we essentially spent the necessary resources. But this is something we don't really like doing. We don't really like having to make everything be entry. There's lots of rules, regulations. But the internet has left us in a rough position there. We really need to take better measures to regulate to make sure that our environment is maintained. And we do need to remember, too, that people come out here because of the amazing natural environment, and partly, too, because of the host Hawaiian culture, of all the benefits that has to offer people.
Is there a viable alternative in your mind to tourism?
Yeah, I mean, I think we always run this problem of a dominant industry. We really have two big dominant industries here. One is the U.S. military. I'd be really surprised to see the U.S. military be a growth industry in future years. I think if we look up 25 years from now, its presence is going to be smaller for a whole variety of reasons. Tourism, I think, is always going to be a presence here because Hawaii is a really desirable place. People are going to want to visit. Part of it is us trying to shape that a little bit, but we also need to remember we can't, if we try shaping every detail, it doesn't work. I mean, just that people find ways around that regulation. I do think as far as alternative industries go, the number one thing that we need to try to do is to make sure that Hawaii is a friendly place for business, for startups, and for companies to start to reach some maturity. I still think we have a ways to go on that. The recent controversy over spending at the University of Hawaii, where people who are only engaged in research were targeted for budget cuts, is, I think, a really bad place for the state to be. University of Hawaii research is really essential for the future of the state. And it's not just University of Hawaii research. I mean, it's the spinoffs that result from that. There's a potential to have a high-tech industry here. And in the past, we've really had a rough time trying to find what's the right road to stimulate a high-tech industry. There was a period, the 1970s, and 1980s, even early 1990s, where we mostly relied upon state-run ventures, state-run corporations that would engage in certain research ventures, state-run incubators. Then we kind of took the opposite tack in the 2000s, where we passed Act 221. We provided massive research subsidies to firms engaged in certain businesses. But the subsidies were so high that we ended up with firms gaming the system. It was a really bad venture, and the state repealed it after 8 or 9 years of existence. Today, what we need to be looking at are small nudges that will help some of these industries. We need to be asking how our infrastructure supports these industries. And we just need to be careful about picking the exact industries for the future. What we really need to be doing is to be laying an infrastructure so that new firms find this a hospitable place to start up new ventures.
The book is called Hawaii, 800 Years of Political and Economic Change. Sumner LaCroix is the author. Sumner, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.